How many trees have you planted? Now, besides being a retort to critics, I think of that every now and then, because to plant trees, which grow so slowly, you have to believe in the future and that there are still some things to come. You have to believe that there will be people there and institutions and families, and that there will be work and even a time for pleasure. I say all that as a way to introduce Ray and Pat Harwick. For they have planted a tree at Lancaster Seminary with this lecture, a tree that has begun to grow and will continue to grow for many years into the future. They are people of faith, both being ordained ministers. They have been pastors, teachers, leaders in congregations, and now in these years serving as consultants to congregations as people of faith seek to raise resources for the life and work of the church. It is not only at Lancaster Seminary that they have planted trees. But tonight I ask you to join me in thanking them for this tree that they have planted in creating this lectureship. And we are privileged this evening to sit under its shade and enjoy the blessings of God. So I'd like Ray and Pat to stand and let us welcome them and express our thanks to them. Pat Harwick has had the privilege of studying with our speaker, and so she is going to introduce him. And so I present to you Pat Harwick.
It's my very special privilege and pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Luke Timothy Johnson. I first met Dr. Johnson when I was a first-year seminarian at Yale Divinity School, which is somewhere up in New England. You may have heard of that place. I suspect at every seminary there are stories that abound about how New Testament professors love to tear apart biblical texts with the same kind of ruthless abandon of an overzealous biologist faced with a dead cadaver, leaving a devastated seminarian wondering whatever happened to the words that were so familiar and so loved. I am forever grateful to Dr. Johnson for my introduction to biblical studies at Yale, because he taught me to analyze texts with a rigor and in a critical fashion without ever losing sight of the fact that these are also inspired testimonies of people of faith seeking to describe in words their experience of the mysterious and the divine. Dr. Johnson reminded us over and over again that these words demanded both our critical study and our sense of awe and reverence. After graduation, I encountered Dr. Johnson in his wonderful book, Sharing Possessions, a book that probably more than any other book has shaped my own understandings of stewardship. His book has been for me and continues to be both intellectually stimulating and personally challenging as I work through my own understandings of the role of possessions and wealth and money in the discipline of faithful living. Dr. Johnson is a Roman Catholic layman at this point. He was formerly a Benedictine monk and a priest and spent many years in a monastery. He received his PhD in New Testament studies from Yale University. His dissertation, The Literary Function of Possessions in Luke Acts, laid the groundwork for his book, Sharing Possessions, Mandate and Symbol of Faith. He taught at Yale Divinity School, at Indiana University, and is now the Robert Woodruff Professor of New Testament and Christian Origins at Candler School of Theology at Emory University in Atlanta. After his words that he will share with us this evening, there will be time for questions and discussion, so please stay for that as well. And please now welcome with me Dr. Luke Timothy Johnson.
Thank you, Pat, for that introduction. Hello to everybody. Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here. The story of the widow's mite has probably been used in predictable ways and with considerable effect by ecclesiastical fundraisers. This evening, I would like to use it as the starting point for a theological reflection. In Luke's Gospel, as well as Mark's, the saying concludes a series of disputations between Jesus and various Jewish leaders in the temple precincts. Here's how Luke describes it. And in the hearing of all the people, he said to his disciples, "Beware of the scribes who like to go about in long robes and love salutations in the marketplaces and the best seats in synagogues and the place of honor at feasts, who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation." He looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. And he saw a poor widow put in 2 copper coins. And he said, "Truly, I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all of them. For they all contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, put in all the living that she had." And as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with noble stones and offerings, he said, "As for these things which you see here, the days will come when there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." This is from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 20, 45 to 21, 6. There's a parallel in Mark 12, 38 to 13, 2. Now, the best way to use this text as a source for theological reflection may be simply to sit down and shut up so that we could all think about it. But you asked me here to say some words, so I will. You've no doubt already noticed that I did not read the passage about the widow in isolation, but I placed it in its literary context, which is the same in both Mark and Luke. Now we have Jesus' comments on 3 situations that come to his attention. All 3 situations involve the use of possessions, and cumulatively, they have a devastating impact, with Jesus' words about the widow appearing not as sentimental piety, but as searing prophecy. We might expect the harshness of the first and last statements, directed in turn against the scribes and the adornments of the temple, even though, if we observe them carefully, they still have the capacity to make us squirm. Those noble stones and offerings that Jesus includes in his summary prediction of the temple's destruction, after all, were precisely the ancient Jewish equivalent of endowed buildings with memorial plaques attached to the gifts of pious donors. Similarly, we might wonder whether the ancient scribes, with their religious garb and their demeanor and their public posturing, were so far different from contemporary examples of televangelists swallowing the houses of widows for their own grand projects. But the more we ponder the middle saying, the more difficult it becomes. The saying is obviously structured by a double contrast between the wealthy on the one hand and the destitute widow on the other, between the gifts of the rich given out of their excess and the gift of the widow out of her neediness. The widow is said to give more than all the rest, not because of the size of her gift, but because of its relatively radical character. By donating 2 of the smallest coins in circulation, she was giving away all of her life, her bios, her means of sustenance, everything that supported her marginal existence. The wealthy could give greater amounts, but with less impact on themselves. The measure of giving, it seems, is here less the product than the cost. Well, this is hard, but it's not confusing. What gets confusing is the setting for the contrast. Remember, that treasury there in the temple was, as we understand by reading rabbinic literature, the so-called Chamber of Secrets. And before the destruction of the temple, it was the method used to fulfill the demands of Torah for the collection of alms for those perennially dispossessed in a land-based economy, in a patriarchal society, namely widows, orphans, and sojourners, read transients and homeless. Knowing this fact makes Jesus' saying more complex and challenging still, for the wealthy depositing their gifts in the Chamber of Secrets are certainly not to be identified with the scribes devouring the houses of widows. Nor were they making contributions simply for the adornments of the temple that might bear their name to their own self-glorification. They were, in fact, seeking to fulfill the covenantal demands of caring for widows and orphans. They are contributing precisely to such people as the widow. But they do so in an indirect and organized fashion rather than directly to the widow. Yet there is no hint in this story that Jesus condemns these rich folk who are making contributions. They are simply not giving as radically as that widow does. The widow herself, of course, is the intended recipient of such organized welfare in the Jewish community. Indeed, is the classic exemplar of the needy person in the ancient world. Yet she herself gives to the charity collection. She is not simply receiver, but also giver. Even if such giving places her in a situation still more perilous, still more in need of rescue. Now, some things in this text are clear. The unambiguous denunciation of possessions gained by oppression and fraud, the ostentatious use of possessions for religious self-glorification. But when it comes down to the question of how we are to read this passage as a guide for our faithful use of possessions, the passage about the rich people and the widow is less clear. Jesus' tone is absolute and radical. But what is he saying? Before pursuing that puzzlement, let me introduce another sort of text that we must always employ if our theological reflections are to be authentic. Which is the text of experience. When we lift our eyes from the puzzling and demanding words of the gospel to the lives of our fellow humans on the planet, however, we meet texts equally absolute in moral force, but also equally deficient in clear direction. None of us has the least difficulty in cataloging the disasters known to us either by first-hand experience or observation or through the news media. In our country, the homeless, the impoverished, the jobless, the undereducated and the overstimulated, the narcotized and the marginalized. Abroad, the truly appalling masses of the destitute, whether occasionally as in Eastern Europe or chronically as in India and Pakistan, whether at the edges of utter extinction as in the Sudan and Somalia, or at the nagging edge of modernity as in Latin America. Such texts cannot but make us flinch and recoil. We can scarcely gaze on the face of such ceaseless and growing suffering. Once more, the text of our experience calls out to us clearly, do something. You must do something. But what are we to do? The easiest answers are the simple answers. We can leave all our possessions and join the poor, which will clear our conscience, but also make us dependent on someone with less enthusiasm, but steadier work. Or we can marshal all our energies for the reformation of societal and economic systems that encourage or necessitate oppression and greed. But that option, in light of recent evidence concerning the true state of affairs of those living under socialist regimes, has become less attractive, even if it were feasible. What then? Simply a life conformed to the acquisitive patterns of our own society? No more than the text of Scripture does the text of our lives produce a clear mandate for the use of our possessions, which means that most of us mainly muddle through, deprived alike of clean hands or clear concepts. It is important for us to understand, however, that this state of affairs is inevitable simply because of who we are as humans and the subject that we are considering. Matters that cut so close to the bone of our individual and communal sense of identity as that of being and having, that demand our use of language so slippery as that attaching to words such as rich and poor, that inevitably involve not only our minds, but also our tangled emotions of longing and desire and fear and regret, that call into question, finally, even the condition of our fragile physical existence. In such matters, any position that purports to be simple or straightforward is by that very fact recognizable as inauthentic. Discussing matters such as possessions or power or sexuality is also always messy because it always drags in our own stories. We cannot, without distortion, distance ourselves from such subjects. We cannot pretend that we ourselves have no stake in the analysis. We each bring a tangled narrative of involvement and commitment and hope and disappointment to the discussion. Such should not be cause for dismay. On the contrary, our discussion is enriched and enlivened by the multiple perspectives that are brought to it. If our discussion thereby becomes more complex and murky, then we are closer to the truth. For the truth is that we are all involved in a mystery of existence and non-existence, of being and having, as complex and murky as our own bodies. Only when we fail to acknowledge this do we move further away from the truth of our subject, which is the truth of somatic spiritual existence. And like each of you, I bring my own past perplexities to the topic of faith and the faithful use of possessions. I was the sixth and final child of my widowed mother, who lived in the economically depressed area of northern Wisconsin and who struggled to clothe and feed her children, yet taught them the beauty of music and poetry from their earliest years, and taught me also thereby that terms such as poverty and wealth are not only relative, but also bear qualitative as well as quantitative dimensions. For some 15 years, I lived within the context of Benedictine monasticism, first as a seminarian and then as a professed monk. I found the security offered by a community of possessions a definite step up economically. But I also discovered, painfully, that a great renunciation by vow does not remove the vice of acquisitiveness, but only transfers it to other realms. Discovered as well that the relative material poverty guaranteed by a community of possessions was more than compensated for by the wealth given by means of security and lack of responsibility. At 28, I married a woman with 6 children who had been married to a wealthy entrepreneur, yet who left a life of luxury for the sake of her children to accept a new life with a literally penniless graduate student in New Testament studies with, at best, dubious prospects. From her, I learned that freedom and dignity and respect are possessions far greater in value than grand homes and the capacity to travel wherever one wanted. As that graduate student and then junior professor at Yale, I learned what living a middle-class existence without middle-class means was like. And that genteel poverty was a euphemism for grinding effort wedded to anxiety. I learned as well what that can do to the spirit as a less than living wage from an Ivy League institution, together with massive family medical bills, made the poverty of the religious life look attractive indeed by comparison. Then, after years of teaching at a state university department of religious studies, I learned the peculiar bitterness of spirit that envy can generate. The envy being, in this case, the constant state of humanities professors gazing at their endowed and funded colleagues in the sciences and the professions. And then, just a few years ago, quite by accident and somewhat embarrassingly, I became the holder of an endowed chair in a university where my struggle now involves the relative wealth implied by such a position, together with the relative poverty represented by coming to such a position so late in life, and where that personal struggle pales before the reality of life in a city such as the one I live in, Atlanta, where ostentatious, unbelievable wealth, obscene wealth and privilege sit side by side with neighborhoods so desolate and destroyed that passage through them cannot but bring one to tears. Now, I've not burdened you with this recital because I think it is particularly edifying or exemplary. Just the opposite. It is to assure you that I occupy no privileged vantage point for speaking about the mystery of possessions, and to invite you to bring your own stories as well into your reflection. I've also shared some of my story in order to help you see what kinds of questions I brought, or which brought me, to my own theological engagement with the texts of Scripture. My original ambitions for my PhD dissertation had been grandiose. I had wanted to compare the ways in which group ideologies and community practice reinforced each other in representative communities in the Hellenistic world, with special reference to the use of possessions. Doesn't that sound like a grandiose dissertation? As it turned out, simply trying to figure out what was happening in a single New Testament writing, Luke Acts, took up the whole study. The fascinating thing about Luke's two-volume work, which I was not the first to notice, was that although he consistently spoke about possessions, he did not speak about possessions consistently. The more I studied Luke's narrative and the use of possessions language in the context of that narrative, the clearer it became to me that possessions language served a literary function, and thus the title of my dissertation, The Literary Function of Possessions in Luke Acts. Luke, I saw, use the states of rich and poor and the disposition of possessions as symbols for modes of response to God's visitation in history through God's prophets. Throughout Luke's story, those who reject the call of God are rich, lovers of money, possessive, acquisitive, greedy, fraudulent. Those who accept God's call are the poor, and those who freely share their possessions with others. In such a reading, the two stories in Acts 4:32 to 5:11, you remember the description of the community of possessions, and then the story of Ananias and Sapphira, stand as perfect exemplars of the diverse responses. Those who shared a spiritual unity symbolized it by laying their possessions at the feet of the apostles and enjoyed the blessings of the Messianic age. But the couple, Ananias and Sapphira, who broke spiritual unity by conspiring together and symbolized that conspiracy by holding back a portion of their possessions, ended up dead at the feet of the apostles. Literally cut off from the people that God was forming. Luke's interest, I concluded, was not, first of all, possessions, but in the response to God of obedient faith. But he found in possessions language a powerful symbol to express relationships of power and of human self-disposition. Possessions as a symbol of power and human self-disposition. Now, given the nature of dissertations, I was not able to pursue the theological implications of that exegetical conclusion until I was asked to contribute a book to a series called Overtures to Biblical Theology, which I entitled Sharing Possessions, Mandate and Symbol of Faith. Now, since in this study I was seeking what connection could be found between the life of faith and the faithful use of possessions, I realized that I had to begin with a phenomenological analysis of the mystery of human possessing, discovering not only how profoundly ambiguous was our ordinary language about possessions, but also how inevitably and irreducibly paradoxical was the actual claim to have anything by creatures who cannot even account for their very being. Chastened by these reflections, I turned once again to Luke Acts, this time not to discover the literary trope concerning possessions, but rather in the search for a mandate to guide human practice. And what I found, once more, was that Luke Acts actually contained too many mandates and too many irreconcilable ones concerning possessions, forcing the reader who takes the text seriously as a guide to life toward one of several hermeneutical strategies. Reading Luke Acts, we could conclude that only those economically poor are really part of God's kingdom, the preferential option for the poor. And on that basis, would take literally the command to leave all possessions to follow Jesus. If we did that, however, then we would not be able to fulfill another and equally serious commandment, namely to give alms to the poor. Nor could we give alms if we followed another apparent prescription, namely that Christians join all their possessions in a community of goods. The mandates, folks, cancel each other out. So what are we to do? Select one mandate as normative and relegate the others to the level of advice or counsel? That's the method usually followed, leading Christians variously to become mendicants, monks, or philanthropists. Philanthropy is that Christian virtue in which the process of acquiring is much more fascinating than the process of dispossessing. Or should we give up the hope of finding a clear directive for our lives on this matter in Scripture? So the approach I took was to extend the inquiry to the whole of the Bible. This Luke Acts is bad enough, so let's look at all the books in the Bible, see if we can make this a little more difficult. And my point was to seek whether this consistent inconsistency of Luke Acts was peculiar to that writing or a more pervasive feature of all of Scripture. I found, of course, that Luke Acts is in no way distinctive in this regard. Every aspect of Torah, whether of the law or of the prophets or of the writings, connect the use of possessions to covenantal faith in the one God. Faith in the one God demands certain ways of using possessions. The opposite of that faith, called biblically idolatry, leads to quite different uses of possessions. And when I scanned the other New Testament texts, I found the same connection between monotheistic faith and the proper use of possessions, between idolatry and the misuse of possessions. So the Bible, taken as a whole, has a bewildering variety of specific commands concerning possessions. But of far greater interest is the premise underlying all such specific commands, a mandate which I characterize as the sharing of possessions as the mandate of faith. It is the mandate of faith in God because such faith sees all the ways that we are and have as irreducibly gift, given at every moment and never completely in our control. And since faith sees our lives as gifted, at once always full and always empty, the logic of faith is to share this gift with others. Idolatry, in contrast, which refuses to acknowledge that we are gifted, but seeks to establish our existence and worth on the basis of our own efforts, must logically use possessions as a means of asserting both. We are, after all, what we have. The logic of idolatry, therefore, is envy and competition leading to mutual elimination. Since life is a zero-sum game demanding that if one has more, another must have less, and the one who dies with the most toys wins. In its negative form, the mandate of faith is clear and consistent. Faith forbids all acquisitiveness and greed and envy as intrinsically the expression of idolatry. Therefore, all stealing and fraud and oppression and perverting of justice and the moving of landmarks and the withholding of wages and the neglecting of widows and orphans and sojourners is consistently and emphatically interdicted. In contrast, the mandate for the positive sharing of possessions is far more various and uncertain. And it was this side of the issue that most intrigued me. Why so definite on the negative side, yet so vague on the positive? One reason could be the notorious difficulty with all positive commands. Negative commands are easy to spell out and to observe, for they exclude a specific form of behavior, but allow all others. Positive commands, because they are open-ended, tend to be difficult both to define and to fulfill. Contrast, thou shalt not kill, which leaves open all the positive ways of giving life, to love your neighbor as yourself, which has made neurotics of us all. Something more than the difficulty of definition is at work here, though. The vagueness and open-endedness of the mandate, share possessions, is connected, I think, directly to the open-ended character of faith in the living God. God moves ahead of us in all the circumstances of our lives and calls us to respond in those specific and ever-changing circumstances. In the last book I devoted to this subject called Faith's Freedom, I tried to analyze more closely this pattern of faithful obedience as a kind of constant, It's better my airplane this afternoon. I'm going to back up on that last point. I see faithful obedience as a kind of constant oscillation between idolatry and faith, between closure and openness. Our every instinct as humans is to close and to protect our own projects and possessions. But God calls us to a more open and frightening space. When we obey that call and let go for the moment of our projects and possessions by which we want to define ourselves, we experience both the terror and the thrill of freedom. Yet, no sooner do we enter into that open space than we begin to fence it in and furnish it according to our tastes, turning God's call and gift once more into our project and possession. In other words, I've begun to understand Luther's simul justus et peccator, at once justified and sinner, in terms not of a static relationship over against God, but of a dynamic process. It is not as though we remain statically in one place, yet God justifies us anyway by decree. There is rather, by gift, a growth toward God. The gift we call grace is always from God's side, through the intrusive interruptions of our projects by others. On our side, we constantly try to fit that gift into a frame that we can control. And if we tended only to our tendency toward idolatry, we would despair. Our hope lies in the living God, who can constantly gift us through others, because God's self remains constantly other. Between faith professed and faith enacted, therefore, lies discernment. God's call comes to us in constantly changing circumstances which resist prediction or control. For faith to be truly obedient, that is, creatively loyal to the one calling and not simply our stubbornly sticking by our previous commitment, it must discern in the constantly altering face of real life the appropriate way for faith to respond. This is the perilous and terrifying freedom of faith. We never know whether our specific choice is right, but can only trust that our way of choosing is righteous. What this means for the faithful disposition of possessions is, I think, clear. The mandate of faith is, in the most proper sense, to symbolize faith. Faith needs to be embodied in ever-changing ways in response to the call of God. That embodied response in physical action, and specifically in the disposition of possessions, is not symbolic in some weakened sense of that term as though it were a metaphor, but in its fullest sacramental sense, it affects what it signifies. Acquisitiveness, greed, oppression, these all obviously symbolize the response of idolatry. That is, they make it real in bodies. But every open-handed sharing of possessions equally enacts the very essence of faith. It is in this respect that the obediential faith of Jesus, which expressed itself in the complete receptivity to the call of God in every circumstance and in the self-emptying service to his neighbor at every moment, can be seen as the Christological exemplar for the sharing of possessions. As Paul put it in 2 Corinthians, "You know the gift of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich." It was in light of this understanding of sharing possessions as the symbol of faith that in the last chapter of the book, Sharing Possessions, I attempted to assess two formal attempts to structure the positive sharing of possessions, namely the ideal of community goods, which has always tempted the Christian tradition, and the Jewish practice of community almsgiving. My assessment relied completely on which model of sharing best symbolize the essential movement of faith as obedience to the living God. Now, reciting the details of that analysis would be tedious, but I concluded that Christians would do well to abandon the first ideal and learn something from the second, as in so many other areas we have a page to read from Judaism. Now, if you want to engage that issue in discussion, I'd be delighted. But in the final moments of this formal presentation, I would like to conclude with some propositions or theses concerning faith and the faithful use of possessions that might sharpen whatever discussion that follows and inform the workshop that some of us will be having tomorrow. I have 14 points, so please be patient. 14 theses. This is just sort of things I want to put on the table. First, as spiritual somatic creatures, we are inevitably caught in the paradoxical condition of both being and having. We truly have no choice whether we are to possess, but only what we are to possess and how we are to use our possessions. In other words, we can't get away from this. Two, the way we dispose of our possessions is the symbol of our spiritual commitments, just as the disposition of our bodies enacts the desires of our hearts. Three, our possessions include far more than material things. They include time, space, ideas, dreams, emotions, projects, virtue, spiritual status, whatever we might want to claim as mine or share as ours. Fourth, the living God we encounter as other, as we meet all those who are others in our lives, calls us out of the claim of possessing into the gift of freedom. Fifth, our idolatrous impulse to self-determination, expressed by our identifying our being with our having, is potentiated by sin, by our refusal of that call of God to us through others, expressed by an absolutizing of our claim to possession of what we have and of our life. Sixth, obediential faith in the living God means, in effect, relinquishing our absolute hold on what is ours, whether money or time or space or ideas or reputation or self-image or even our notion of what faith demands, and allowing those possessions to be relativized by God's project. Seventh, the specific way in which the obediential faith in God is enacted is in our response to those others we encounter in our lives, and in the ways their needs, projects, desires, demands intersect and thereby relativize our own. Eight, the response of faith is never once for all, but is a lifelong series of responses to a God who constantly moves ahead of us and has a tendency to surprise. Therefore, it is contrary to the nature of obedient faith to expect a single, once-for-all disposition of our possessions that need never be challenged or changed. Nine. Although that mandate of faith, which forbids the idolatrous clinging to possessions, deriving from envy, fear, compulsion, greed, and covetousness, is absolute, the symbolization of faith in the positive sharing of possessions must always remain relative to the character of the circumstances in which God's call comes. To be precise, the mandate is absolute, but the mode of its enactment is always circumstantial. Tenth, the role of discernment in the faithful disposition of possessions is critical, For if such sharing is to be determined not by our projects, but by the needs of others, then those needs must carefully be assessed in qualitative as well as quantitative terms. Only spiritual discernment can make faith truly obedient, which is to say, truly creative, flexible, and open to the one who calls. 11. The sharing of possessions, that is, the symbolization of living faith, must always maintain some genuine face-to-face and personal contact with those with whom possessions are being shared. Otherwise, the sharing simply becomes a rigid program to which we are committed and may no longer respond to the real needs of those we are serving. This applies as well, of course, to such sharing of spiritual possessions as teaching and preaching. The teacher who has no office hours and does not learn the stories of students is alienated from the faithful sharing of intellectual possessions. The preacher who does no pastoral counseling and therefore does not hear the stories of parishioners is alienated from the faithful sharing of spiritual possessions. 12. Since as embodied creatures we are also thereby inevitably social creatures, the way we gather ourselves socially into intentional communities has the same symbolic significance as it does for individuals. For Christians, this means that the faithful use of possessions is not simply a matter of individual faith, but must express the faith of the community as well. 13. What was said in the previous points about the faith of the individual therefore applies as well to the church as a community of faith. It has no choice as to whether it's going to possess, but only how much it possesses and how it uses those possessions. Likewise, with the other points, the church's possessions include more than financial resources, also intellectual and spiritual resources. The call of faith demands on the negative side the refusal to define identity on the basis of possessions or their acquiring, and on the positive side, faith demands the sharing of all possessions, but the modes of sharing are determined by the discernment of the community, and such discernment focuses not on the self-image of the church, but on the needs of others, demanding therefore a constant attention and face-to-face engagement. What most distinguishes the faithful sharing of possessions by a church community from the faithful sharing by individual believers is the relative complexity of life together. Decisions must be made. Organization is required. This means, on the one hand, that spontaneity is necessarily lessened. On the other hand, it makes the constant practice of discernment and personal knowledge of those being served all the more necessary. For the inertia of community self-serving is a more constant danger. I close these perhaps too wide-ranging reflections. I've tried to suggest some of the elements that I think must go into any theological reflection: the careful consideration of the normative texts by which we live, and an equal attention to the experiences and circumstances of human life. By allowing these texts to speak to each other, we discover even more complexity, but also certain simple principles that might guide our thinking and our action. Such principles are themselves, of course, far too broad to constitute a comfortable program of action, especially not one that we could institute and then forget about. And that may be the most important conviction I want to share with you this evening. The one thing we most want is to be able to organize our life so that it does not require our presence. The one thing we most want is to be able to organize our life so that it does not require our presence. We want an answer in our pocket as a possession, so that we can have the comfort and security that we are doing the right thing. We do not want constantly to have to review our projects, have them challenged,
We hate and detest discernment. Here is where our desire and God's seem to conflict. For apparently, our comfort and security in being right is low on God's agenda. In one of Scripture's most dramatic passages, the prophet Micah proposes a number of once-for-all projects that might please God. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Then the prophet answers his own question. He has showed you, humans, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? God, it seems, does not require a present, but a presence, which is the only gift that we can distinctively give to God by giving it each moment to each other. Thank you.
I'm struck by your 11th point, which, if I remember, had to do with face-to-face presentation of gift, of sharing of possessions. Yes. And I like that very much. I wonder if you can make a differentiation between sharing possessions and hospitality. It strikes me that the notion of hospitality really has to do with this kind of face-to-face and creating space. I think also, for instance, of the work of Doug Meeks about oikos, the creating of a household. Can you talk a little bit about, there differentiation and how would you see that? So.
It seems to me that they are, thank you for that question. Let me say just a word about the importance of the face-to-face thing, because it seems to me that it is, more and more I've been coming to think that Jean-Paul Sartre had it completely wrong. You know, when Sartre said, the other is hell. And it seems to me that in some sense that is our contemporary idolatry. We want to suppress otherness. We want to suppress otherness either by projects of willfulness or willlessness. Either let ourselves be overwhelmed by the other and enter into it, or to take over the other. But the capacity to live in tension with others and embrace others, especially in their otherness, not abstract otherness, oh yeah, those people, very fine. But in the face-to-face ways in which the otherness of the other intrudes into our project is extraordinarily important for the life of faith. And I cannot help but feel that one of the most obvious ways in which our society is indicted as faithless in its lack of possessions is to pick up your point about hospitality. And that is the way in which we do not give place to those who interrupt us, the useless, the non-productive, the aged. We hate children. You know, we want a childless kingdom because children represent the needy, you know, the useless, the demanding, the messy, they interrupt our lives, they interrupt our career, they interrupt our time, they mess up our lives. So those who are ugly, those who are damaged, those who are somehow weird, we find more and more clever ways of getting outside our space. And by so doing, folks, we are eliminating the other. As we create, you know, enclaves of a likeness, whether of belief or ideology or color or gender or whatever other purple-haired identity indicator we would like to appeal to. We are failing, as you suggest, in that fundamental hospitality, which is to allow the other into our space. And so in some sense, the language I'm using about sharing possessions as a kind of an outward gesture of moving into a larger space has as its the yin and yang of that is the hospitality, allowing the other to enter into my space. And I think that the two things are cognate, obviously, and represent much the same thing. Except that, in many respects, hospitality is even harder because it is more makes us more vulnerable. I mean, after all, even the discernment of the needs of others, even the reading of their face, of their body language, even the hearing of their story to try to figure out what is it that I can share with you, is itself perilously close to enacting my project of being a caring person. But when somebody who's suffering from schizophrenia stands up, as happened to me a couple of weeks ago at the end of a lecture, and started screaming out, Professor Johnson, I want to ask you a question. And I was sort of hustled off the podium to protect me from this awful person, and the police grabbed this person and took them off in a ambulance for his own good. That's such a profound failure in hospitality. We ought to have a way to be able to do that. I always find that a sign of a really good lecture is to suppress all thought.
Chances are that in a group such as this tonight, each one of us has a favorite person who probably most fully illustrates the definitions and descriptions which you so well have given us tonight. I wonder if you would cite that person in your experience and tell us just a little bit about her or him.
Who exemplifies this, the image of faithful use of possessions. I think that I was extraordinarily fortunate when, as a very young man, I went into a monastery, which was a community of faith, and I was extremely fortunate to have to live with a couple of men, my novice master and my abbot, whom I regard truly as saints, people who simply poured out their life in service to others. Without, not a kind of a codependent, masochistic, kind of way, but I mean, fundamentally were utterly simple in their capacity to... the rule of Taizé... Ta disponibilité, your disposability or your accessibility implies a continual simplification of your life, not by constraint, but by faith. And in these men, I experienced that kind of simplicity. The simplicity of simple attentiveness, of simple presence. The other person is my wife, Joy, who demonstrates for me, above all, the gift of otherness. Joy is so emphatically other that she humbles me daily in my incapacity to make her fit her into my projects. So she defines grace for me, because I constantly sort of want to, you know, get the neighborhood organized according to my controlling impulses, and joy is a totally alien force that I must always remain open to, with the only alternative being destruction.
I was very struck by your analysis of the inner logic of greed as idolatry, simply because that opened up Ephesians chapter 5, where
yes,
greed is equated in such an offhand and parenthetical manner with idolatry.
Exactly.
And never explained, as if every person reading that letter in the ancient world would have immediately got it, whereas I'm not sure we do get it when we read it.
That's right. It's exactly right. In Ephesians, Paul said, avoid all covetousness, which is idolatry. You know, or the word is pleonexia, which is the craving disease, the need to have more. And you're exactly right. And I think you're also right that everybody in the ancient world probably would have caught it. And that is the analysis of the biblical analysis of idolatry is very, very close to the Greco-Roman philosophical analysis of envy, in which the envy was called by, in a saying attributed to Socrates, as the ulcer of the soul. And it was defined by Aristotle as that sorrow that we experience because another has what we do not. And the ancients saw that the logic of that envy, of that craving to have, first of all, to identify being and having, so that if somebody had more than I did, they were more than I was, and that therefore the only way that I could live with that would be to tear them down. And so in ancient political theory, all wars, revolutions, political instability, and so forth comes from envy, which is a function of the craving disease, this idolatry, this attempt to have control of the and of course the inability to sustain the presence of otherness, you know, of something different. Your being different is such an affront, you know. Marvelous book by Miroslav Volf from Fuller School of Theology, whose title it's Inclusion and Something, but if you see the word, what is it? You've read it? It's a great book. And what course do you teach, sir? It reminds me of David Smith at Indiana University used to say, somebody say, have you read this book? He said, read it, I haven't even lectured on it yet. Inclusion and Embrace, and it's a marvelous, and I would recommend this very, very highly because it's the best theological reflection on this issue of our present refusal of otherness that I have read. And he himself is Yugoslavian and came out of the Croatian-Bosnian sort of conflict, and the way in which the sort of ethnic rivalries and so forth have generated these centuries of, you know, these sort of cells of identity, the politics of identity leading to a kind of mutual extinction. You wanted to follow up? Yeah. Well, in some sense, I think you're absolutely correct that idolatry tends to be wrong belief or an unfortunate paganism that's crept into your life or something, rather than this entire pattern of course I'm using the Book of Wisdom 13 following and Paul in Romans above all for my analysis of idolatry, which is really an analysis of human behavior in terms of the big lie. The knowing that we are contingent creatures and the refusal to acknowledge that. And so in one sense, I think it is a recovery of those analyses which helps. The thing that I have been thinking about lately, though, is that I'm pretty well convinced that idolatry is our natural state. And we seem to be created that way. And if we're created that way, apparently God intended us to be that way. And tomorrow I'll talk about the difference between idolatry and sin and faith and grace. So if you want to hang around, I'll try to untangle that. Yes, sir.
In the lecture, you created a conversation among hospitality, discernment, and otherness, and also in some of the questions that have come up. And in that conversation among those three things, I think what hits me is serving as a pastor in a West Baltimore congregation right in the heart of the city, inviting otherness into your house, be it my personal house in my neighborhood or the house where I pastor, can be deadly.
Yeah.
And so what is one's response when you want to be open to otherness, but literally it can cost you your life?
Mm-hmm.
And so I've had a group of people, for instance, in my parish, that want to reflect upon this, maybe looking at the Luke 10 Samaritan kind of thing, or how does one get at that when otherness really costs you your life if you invite the wrong person in?
That's such a superb question, because it really does cut, I think, to the complexity of every human situation and the absolute need for discernment of that. I mean, so that if we sort of say, okay, hospitality is now going to be our project, y'all come, right? You know, bring your own gun, or, you know, something like this. You're posing precisely the kind of community discernment process that I think is absolutely necessary to engage this. You know, what is it that we're talking about? You know, what is our circumstance? How can we begin to do this? How should we not do it? You know, what other kinds of loyalties and commitments are we endangering if we do it carelessly? What are we nurturing if we do it, you know, in a careful way? And again, it seems to me that the classic instance of, I mean, Joy and I, have these kinds of debates where, you know, she says things like, well, doesn't Jesus says more things that I never knew. I mean, Joy is a complete apocryphal gospel all by herself, because, you know, the Jesus seminar should have consulted her, because it's sort of like, didn't Jesus say this? And I say, well, kind of, but so she gets off the phone to, you know, one of our 80 dysfunctional children, you know, wearing her down to the bone, and I say, honey, just hang up. Just say no. You know, just put some boundaries there, you know. She said, well, doesn't Jesus say that we should give up our lives? I said, for the kingdom of God, not for your children. You know, this is, you know, and it's exactly that kind of issue. You know, when is an openness to the other simply stupid, and when is it hospitable? You know, to be discerning in the face of it does not mean that we have to say yes to anything that's put in our face. And sometimes we must say no for the sake of creative fidelity. But I do think that these are the kinds of challenges to a local church, to a congregation. It's exciting that your community is thinking about that. That is, you know, challenging itself as a hospitable community in a non-hospitable environment. How do you begin to model, how can the church begin to model a mode of presence which might present an exemplar to that more dangerous and hostile environment? But it's hard. That's it. Let's go home. Thank you very much.